You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You've most likely seen the news. Last Wednesday, an attacker shot and killed 18 people and wounded 13 others at a bowling alley and bar in Lewiston, Maine. On Friday, after a two-day manhunt, the suspect was found dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. His motives for the shooting aren't entirely clear at this point. Law enforcement is still completing an investigation. Authorities say, though, that it was likely linked to paranoia. The assailant was committed to a mental health facility after making threats of violence during an Army Reserve training exercise near West Point, New York, back in July. A statewide awareness alert was sent out in September after he made more threats against his base and fellow soldiers. Law enforcement visited his home for a welfare check but never located him. Since these details have emerged, a lot of focus has been placed on his mental health history. But our next guest says it's important not to stigmatize mental health issues in the aftermath of mass violence. Here's Maine's Department of Public Safety Commissioner Michael Soschuk speaking at a press conference at Lewiston City Hall on Saturday.
Something that's incredibly important for us to say and for me to say, and I find myself saying it on a regular basis, just because there's appears to be a mental health nexus to this scenario, the vast majority of people, with a mental health diagnosis will never hurt anybody.
Our next guest is a psychiatrist who helps patients with serious mental illness. She's been at the forefront of educating healthcare providers on how to prevent firearm violence because she says gun violence is more than a political problem in this country. It's also a public health crisis. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of when you see a focus on mental health when we talk about mass shootings and other forms of gun violence? Are there changes in laws you'd like to see? Red flag laws, for example. Do you have questions about where mental illness and firearm access run into each other? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy Barnhorst is an inpatient and emergency psychiatrist, the vice chair for community mental health at the University of California Davis Department of Psychiatry, and associate director of the California Firearms Violence Research Center. She's also the director of the Bullet Points Project, a state-funded effort to develop a firearm violence prevention curriculum for healthcare providers. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
As an expert in firearm law and mental illness, what's been going through your mind as you watch and read media coverage of the tragic shootings in Lewiston?
It's so horrible to see this happen yet again. And it's not surprising that, of course, the mental illness angle has been brought up, as it often is. In the case of this man, it does seem like he was experiencing some symptoms, possibly of a serious mental illness, some paranoia, maybe hearing voices. And in addition to that, he had been hospitalized, it seems like, for some time this summer. And so there's all these questions, as there often are, like, how could a guy like this, who clearly had some mental health problems and had been making threats, how was he able to legally own a bunch of guns? And this is something that comes up over and over again. And I think it really gets to this idea of what do we want to do preventatively in the future? And are we going to target his firearm access? Are we going to target the mental health system? And where do we put the onus on making some changes so that this doesn't keep happening?
As we heard from the Maine Department of Public Safety there, the overwhelming majority of people with diagnosable mental health conditions will not commit an act of violence. And correct me if I'm wrong, many people who commit acts of violence don't have a diagnosable mental health connection. It's not so easy as to say we could solve gun violence by targeting mental health. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. And, you know, as a psychiatrist who works in a very a system with very scarce resources, I would be a traitor to my people to say, oh, we don't need any more bolstering of the mental health system. We absolutely do. We should be putting a lot of money into getting more facilities stood up, more systems resources for people, more psychiatrists, more social workers, more therapists. I mean, the mental health system needs a lot of support in shoring up. However, I don't think that is an effective way to prevent violence, the preponderance of which in the United States is community violence that happens in the context of, you know, domestic violence, neighborhoods that have high levels of poverty, people of color in the context of crimes. It's not mostly mass shootings, even though that's often what many Americans worry about happening to them. Most people who have a serious mental illness are just trying to get by and get to their appointments and keep their housing and get their medications refilled. They're not perpetrating these acts of violence. And like you mentioned, the majority of people who perpetrate these acts of violence don't have a diagnosable or treatable mental illness. But occasionally there is some overlap there. And then, you know, folks often do associate mental illness with mass shootings.
Now, in states around the country, we've seen different versions of what people call red flag laws, the idea that under certain circumstances, under certain procedures, and it varies from place to place, we can remove guns from the hands of the possession of people who were worried about committing an act of violence. Can you talk about some broad strokes, what these laws are and what they try to do?
Yeah, I helped actually work on the development of the law here in California, which we passed in 2014 in the wake of the Isla Vista shooting. And in the subsequent, you know, 5 to 10 years, there's been a number of other ones passed, mostly in the wake of mass shootings, because what was repeatedly happening was somebody who had firearms, often owned them legally or purchased them legally, got on the radar of the police for making threats, behaving erratically, doing things that people perceived as potentially very dangerous, including things like uploading videos, essentially saying on YouTube that they were going to perpetrate some sort of act of mass violence. The problem is, if the person hasn't committed a crime and they're not really clearly meeting the relatively stringent criteria to be involuntarily psychiatrically hospitalized, there's not much police can do. And in Isla Vista here in California, what we saw was that the police went to this guy's house and talked to him because his parents were concerned, other people were concerned about him. And he presented as very well put together. He said, "Oh, I've been having a hard time, but everything's fine." There was no evidence that any crime had been committed. He didn't appear to be mentally ill. He didn't have a mental health history that would have justified some sort of hospitalization. And so the police had no recourse. There was really nothing they could do. This also happened with Parkland, that that guy was on their radar and they knew about him. People were afraid of him, but he wasn't somebody who was arrestable. He wasn't somebody who was committable to a psychiatric hospital. And so he kind of fell through this gap between the mental health system and the criminal justice system. And that's where these red flag laws come in, is that they allow police or family members, in some states, other people as well, to petition to have somebody's guns removed, not because they've committed a crime or not because they appear to be mentally ill, but because they appear to be dangerous. And it really stands on that. And they can work very quickly. So you don't have to wait for a mental health professional to do a long evaluation and diagnose the person and get them into a hospital. Police oftentimes can get an order from a judge over the phone and get the guns out of a threatening situation, or other people can petition for an order with the court and it can be approved and served within, you know, hours or days.
Then, and I think this is something that concerns people who advocate for the Second Amendment and gun rights. As I understand it, there's usually a procedure. If my guns, say, have been taken under these circumstances, there are ways for me to petition to say, no. I am perfectly capable of handling them. What would be the next step in that situation?
Yeah, absolutely. A really good point. So it's not like, you know, anyone can just take your guns away for any reason that they feel a little unease. There is a legal process. Due process is in place. So the respondent to the order within 2 weeks will go to court. They will give the judge their side of the story and say like, oh, you know, hey, I was having a bad time, or I made those statements, but I didn't mean them. And the judge gets a chance to hear the evidence from both sides and then can potentially return the person's firearms if they don't believe that the person continues to be a threat. And here in California, the research that's been done at the center where I work has shown that a lot of these orders, there was an emergency order issued, but then the final order that would happen after that hearing where the respondent got a chance to plead their case, the firearms were returned and the order was lifted. So either, you know, the crisis period had passed in the 2 weeks, or the person wasn't quite as dangerous or threatening as they initially presented. So they don't always go to a longer term order. And even the longer term orders can last months, sometimes up to years with renewals. But it's a civil order. It's not something on your criminal record. It doesn't involve a psychiatric hospitalization. So in some ways it does, with due process in place, it does target people's Second Amendment rights. But one of the things I like about it is that it only targets those rights, and it only targets them temporarily. It doesn't, you know, go on your criminal record. Again, it doesn't involuntarily put you in a hospital and take you out of your home and your community and your job and your social support. It just removes the firearms from a crisis situation with the option of you getting them back.
We're talking to Amy Barnhorst, inpatient and emergency psychiatrist, vice chair for community mental health at the University of California Davis Department of Psychiatry, director of the Bullet Points Project. We're talking about the overlap, the intersection of mental health and firearm violence prevention, as well as red flag and other laws after last week's mass shooting in Lewiston, Maine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Do you think states like Wisconsin should have red flag laws in place? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Amy Barnhorst, expert on firearms law and mental illness, who helped develop California's red flag law and has testified before state legislatures on these issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we could talk about mental health concerns and guns and firearm violence without going into harmful stereotypes or stigmas? Are you a healthcare provider who works with patients who have mental illness? And do you have questions for our guest about her work, helping clinicians understand firearm violence prevention? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Brian?
Well, I'm just, I would say it should be a federally passed law. A red flag law would be awesome for the nation. If someone has the means to carry out their threats and they make the threats and friends and family, neighbors, community realize that this person has made these threats and yet they have the means to carry them out, whether they purchase the guns legally or illegally, they should definitely have them taken away.
Thanks for the call, Brian, at 800-642-1234. Now, in Wisconsin, we don't have a red flag law right now. Amy, could you talk about efforts to bring them into more states? And as Brian was saying, to have a red flag law, stronger ones at the federal level?
Yeah, and this has been really a big push. I mean, when California passed it, there were only two other laws like this in the country, but they were much more limited in scope. And then since the unfortunate number of mass shootings that happened since 2014, we've seen 21 states and Washington, D.C. all pass these laws. And there have been a lot of calls to have a federal red flag law and many other states that have worked on their laws. I know Wisconsin has really put some effort into thinking about putting one together, but hasn't quite, you know, made it happen yet. And in fact, Maine has something that's sort of halfway there, but not quite there. And that has really been called into question after this last shooting. What they did was rather than really going for a red flag law that was specific to somebody who was making threats or exhibiting dangerous behavior that could happen very quickly with very few barriers to take the guns out of the equation, Maine passed what's now being called a yellow flag law because it's tied to their blue paper of psychiatric commitment. So the blue paper is the application to have somebody brought in involuntarily to a mental health hospital. You can also file a yellow paper, hence the name yellow flag law, with that blue paper. But in order to have the firearms removed, you have to have a mental health provider involved that can certify, do an evaluation and certify that the person is dangerous. So, you know, this is problematic if anyone here has ever tried to get an appointment with a mental health provider or get them to do an evaluation. There's a huge shortage across the country, and particularly in Maine. There's not beds, there's not people, there's not, you know, resources to do this. And it just puts this barrier, both a psychological barrier and a temporal one. So if you're a law enforcement officer, rather than just calling a judge on the phone to get the order to remove the firearms, now you have to bring the person in, you have to wait until they can see a mental health practitioner, that person can do an evaluation, more paper gets submitted to the court. It's just a much more arduous process. And you can imagine that it's not going to be quite as effective as something that can happen very quickly in a very serious situation when somebody like this guy is making threats to do something terrible.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Marilyn joins us now in Neenah. Marilyn, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Marilyn, or tell us about?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, I'm definitely supporting big restrictions. I worked in behavioral health in Wisconsin and firsthand know that if a psychiatrist is feeling somebody's not safe to be discharged, if a judge finds them competent, they can be discharged against medical advice. And we have been, you know, I have known personally in many scary situations, psychiatrist is feeling it's not a good if they would have where another psychiatrist would have to give the permission instead of a judge that, you know, really is doesn't have that hands-on interpretation of behavioral health. Anyhow, we need much stronger rules and laws, and there's all kinds of areas that need to be tightened up to protect our society, in my personal experience.
Marilyn, thanks for the call. Marilyn cut out a little bit there, but I think we got the gist for the most part. Amy, what do you think about what Marilyn brought up?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Marilyn. And always nice to hear from other healthcare professionals. That same thing has happened to me where I think someone's really dangerous, but it is out of my hands, and a judge thinks differently and releases the person. And admittedly, sometimes they release the person not because they think they're not dangerous, but here in California, your dangerousness has to be due to a mental illness for you to stay in a psychiatric hospital. We're not a perfect solution for everybody who's a threat. We're just a way to treat the people who are posing a threat because they have a mental illness. So if the person is just, you know, wanting to hurt their neighbor who's having an affair with their wife or kill their ex-boss who fired them, that's not due to a mental illness. And so the judge might release that person regardless of how dangerous they are. And this is exactly how I got involved with the crafting of California's red flag law in the first place, was I wanted something that I and law enforcement and others could use as a stopgap measure for those people who do fall through those cracks.
Thanks for that call, Marilyn, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Amy Barnhorst, Vice Chair for Community Mental Health at the University of California, Davis Department of Psychiatry, talking about gun violence and mental health. Amy, I want to get into some of the other elements of work you are doing, working with healthcare providers on gun violence prevention. What kind of things are you hoping that healthcare providers can do?
Well, one of the things we've found is that healthcare providers really want to be part of the solution to the big public health problem that is gun violence in the United States, but it's not something that's taught in most medical training programs. And many of our patients do rely on us for information about safety and keeping, you know, their household healthy and safe in addition to themselves. But, you know, we're limited by things like time and knowledge and our training. And so the state of California actually passed a bill to fund this program that I run to develop a curriculum to teach mental health care and medical health care providers how to assess patients who are at risk of firearm injury and then intervene with them, usually, you know, hopefully in ways that are voluntary and time limited and collaborative. So, for example, if you are seeing a patient in your family practice clinic and you know, they have a bad breakup, they're drinking more, they're having sort of fleeting thoughts of suicide, but, you know, they're not somebody who merits going to an inpatient psychiatric hospital or something more extreme like that. But this is somebody that might be at risk of, in a time where they're more intoxicated, and if they're a firearm owner, they might be at risk of, you know, making a suicide attempt with their gun. And so having a conversation with them about putting some time and space between them and their firearms in the crisis period, you know, until things have resolved, until some time has passed, is something we teach healthcare providers how to do. So it's not, you know, it's not about getting into people's business about their firearms. It's about really assessing who might be at risk and how can you help them, the way we talk to patients about so many risks about their health and their life. How can we talk to them about their access to firearms or the access to firearms of their, you know, kid who's going through a struggle or their mother-in-law who lives with them and is now having some paranoia due to her dementia, and what can we do to keep the household safe?
And that's for patients who come in to talk to that healthcare provider. Do you have thoughts on ways that, you know, healthcare providers can do public health outreach in the communities to get these messages, even to the people who might not show up in their offices?
Yeah, that's a great question, because so many people don't have good access to healthcare. I think really thinking about this as a public health problem and not about, you know, good and bad, right or wrong, Democrat or Republican, thinking about, you know, firearms are a way of life for many Americans. And one in three or more homes in the US has a firearm in it. And so how do we reach people who do have firearms and just make sure that they're aware of some of the risks and the ways they can mitigate those risks by storing them safely, making sure that people who shouldn't have access to them or people who are in crisis in their household don't have access to them during those times. And kind of treating this like a public health problem, the way we treat things like motor vehicle crashes or cigarette smoking or diet as a public health problem. And physicians aren't, you know, the entirety of the solution here, but I think we can be really important messengers.
As you mentioned, mass shootings like the one in Maine last week are dramatic. They get a lot of attention. They're not the majority of shootings, though. Do you see ways to reach out to other causes of of homicide in particular in this case that aren't the mass shootings that might make the headlines?
Yeah, and really the majority of firearm deaths in the U.S. are suicide. In fact, in Maine in particular, Maine has a very low homicide rate, but their suicide rate is pretty high. 85% of their firearm deaths are suicides in that state. So I think it's really important to have people know that, because in some of the work I've done with firearm owners and shooting instructors and ranges and gun shops, I've learned that most people who are firearm owners take safety very seriously. You know, they're very good about teaching, whether it's their students or their members or their kids, that you have to be really, really careful when you're handling a firearm. But what folks don't seem to talk about as much, and I think this is true, you know, in general, they don't talk about suicide as much. It's a stigmatized topic. It's something that makes people uncomfortable. And people didn't seem to be as aware about the risks of firearms in suicide as they were about the risks of, for example, unintentional injury. I think it's also important to talk about the risks of having a firearm around when you're in some time of interpersonal crisis. You know, I think we all can imagine being driven to the point where we, you know, things got really bad and we wanted to do something terrible. And most of us wouldn't act on that. But sometimes people become really pushed over the edge. They become disinhibited because of drugs or alcohol, or even occasionally, you know, decreased mental capacity. And for those people to have access to a gun during those times, it can really lead to an increased risk of homicide. So just kind of that idea of like, it's not, you know, guns all the time or no guns ever. It's kind of, you know, let's get them away from folks who are in crisis, who are high risk, and work together to make that a collaborative process that is something people can actually talk about and work together on.
Amy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Amy Barnhorst, inpatient and emergency psychiatrist, vice chair for community mental health at the UC Davis Department of Psychiatry. Been looking at red flag laws and the intersection between mental health and firearms as the country mourns 18 lives lost in the Lewiston mass shooting that was last week. On Friday, we had a fun conversation leading up to Halloween about our favorite scary movies. A lot of you called in. Some more joined in after the show by email. Peter from Eden writes, I'm 70 now. When I was about 8, I watched Frankenstein starring Boris Karloff. Was sitting quite close to our black and white TV when the monster's face suddenly filled the screen. I screamed and hid under the dining room table. The rest of my family thought that was hilarious. Thanks for the story, Peter. Dave in Madison mentions The Exorcist. Sharon says the scariest movie we've ever watched was Wait Until Dark with Audrey Hepburn. The build-up of suspense was intense. The whole movie audience jumped and screamed when the attacker jumped at her in the dark house. Nerves jangled for hours. I will say, Sharon, back in the day when I was in high school band camp, they showed that to us. You know, a bunch of surly Gen X teenagers were like, yeah, old movie, whatever. All of us jumped and screamed at the exact moment you're talking about. I'm surprised, you know, nobody alerted the authorities with all the screaming teenagers at band camp. Keep sharing your favorite scary movies. Email ideas at WPR.org. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we dive into the world of divas, what it means to be a prominent, powerful, usually female performer, and how that role has changed in recent years. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a mini radio drama that takes place in Madison just in time for Halloween.
Spooky tales around Halloween have made their way into listeners' ears across the country since almost the birth of radio. In the spirit of this long tradition, we bring you The Haunting of the Orpheum Theater. Here's WPR's A. Emily Ralph.
It's a Friday night in October, and I'm on an American Ghost Walks tour in downtown Madison. This isn't for work or anything, just a normal Friday, but it really got me thinking. With so many reportedly haunted theaters here, I wanted to know which one was the most haunted. Built in 1926, the Orpheum seemed to call out to me, so I arranged to pay a visit. Looking up at this place, there's a feeling of unexpected time travel, like If you step in the wrong spot, you'd suddenly find yourself back in the roaring 20s. I've been here before, of course. There's a strong deja vu. Gives me shivers. Anyway, time to go inside.
Hello? Hello?
Ah, yes, hello. You must be Emily. We've been expecting you. Let me show you around.
If the outside feels like time slipping, the inside is kind of overwhelming. I can almost see all the layers of moments here, stacked on top of each other like sedimentary rock. But instead of fossils, there are, of course, ghosts. Tonight I'm hoping to find two of them, the original night manager and a head usher. I hear keys, but I can't see anything. I'll just put my gear down and fire up my spectral translator. Whoa, you're right there.
Oh, wait, you can see me?
Sure, I have this fancy deal I made.
Well, that's the cat's meow.
Thank you, I think so too. Okay, I have a few questions.
Why, certainly.
So you're the original night manager here?
I've always been the night manager.
So people know you for the sound of your keys. What's that about?
Well, you know, when you're bored and need to do something with your hands, and the noise is actually quite calming.
So interesting. Well, it was nice to meet you.
You too, Emily. Though, I think we'll be talking again pretty soon.
Hello? Hello? I hadn't read about any lady ghosts here. Okay, now let's see if we can find the usher. The legend is that he died falling from the balcony and spends all his time cleaning the floor where he fell. It's fascinating and horrifying, just the thought of being trapped in a loop like that, of doing the same thing over and over again forever. Ugh. Okay, I see a glow. Hello, are you the head usher?
I've always been the head usher.
Everyone keeps saying that. So my understanding is that you died here and just clean this spot every night? What's the deal with that?
Have you ever tried to get blood and popcorn oil out of a carpet?
Well, yes, once actually.
So you know it's basically impossible.
Sure, but... Wait, who is that? What's going on? What's going on?
Can you hear me?
And after three full nights, that's as close as our radio team got to communicating with her. It's amazing. Every night since her death in 1947, Emily has wandered the theater's halls with her recorder, always in pursuit of that one last story. For Wisconsin Public Radio, this has been Emily and the Haunting of the Orpheum Theater. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
WPR's senior spooky correspondent A. Emily Ralph produced that story just in time for Halloween. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Check out Wisconsin Life's Instagram page to catch a behind-the-scenes glimpse of the making of Emily and the Haunting of the Orpheum Theater. Now, who comes to mind when you hear the word diva? Do you think of that person, maybe that performer, in a positive way, negative, a little bit of both? Our next guest has spent a lot of time thinking and writing about a particular kind of diva in the music, pop culture, and celebrity worlds. The Madonnas, Beyoncés, Taylor Swifts, and more, usually, but not always, women. He says the rules and roles of divas have changed over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who comes to your mind when we say the word diva? And are you a fan, a critic, a fan-a-me, a little of both? What gives a performer diva status? What questions do you have about the role of divas in our popular culture? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Spencer Kornhaber is a staff writer at The Atlantic where he covers music and popular culture. His new book is called On Divas, Persona, Pleasure, Power. Spencer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You don't nail down a hard and fast definition of diva, but you've got some guidelines. What is key to someone being definable anyway as a diva?
Right. Well, for most people, diva is sort of like a two-pronged word, right? It means, for most people, it just means female singer. But there's this other definition that has this connotation of being demanding and hard to deal with. And you know, just sort of like tough and self-involved. And obviously that definition sort of flows out of some stereotypes about the first definition, the female singer kind. So I would say, you know, as I looked around popular culture and saw this archetype showing up, not just with women, but with a lot of women, it made me think about what do we really mean when we say someone's a diva? And it comes down to a kind of assertiveness, a kind of pushing your voice, your identity, your desires out into the world in a way that disrupts the world, challenging social norms, challenging manners, and really kind of like cleaving the audience into groups that either love you or really, really don't like you.
If, say, a Midwestern public radio host started acting like a diva, well, I think everyone's going to see that as negative, right? But if somebody at a, I don't know, Beyonce or Madonna level or something like that, I think... as I read a lot of your essays, Spencer, there's a thought that it's okay because they are performing at such a high level that they get to be a diva.
Right, right. Nicki Minaj has this sort of somewhat famous spiel where she talks about being offered pickle juice on set and walking away, like at some photo shoot. And she basically is saying, you know, I really put in a lot of work and thought into what I do. And the people who are working with me need to show me some respect, because otherwise I would just be drinking pickle juice. So it's sort of like this inspirational model of, asking for what you deserve.
And you wrote in a more recent piece in The Atlantic that, quote, divas are the most important entertainers of our time. Can you build on that a little?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look around at the pop music landscape, really the entertainment landscape of the moment, the names dominating it that come to mind are Taylor Swift and Beyonce. You know, Taylor Swift is not just a musician at this point. She's an entire business empire. She just became a billionaire. She has, she has one of the most viewed movies in America right now. We are turning to really, really powerful women to lead the culture right now. You know, we've always had these figures around, and they've often been very, very powerful and successful, but they haven't always centered their own dominance, their own leadership, their own like kind of like mogul capabilities in the way that the divas of our moment are.
Your opening chapter is about Britney Spears, who, since you wrote this piece, since the book came out, released her own book, memoir, looking back at her difficult career, difficult life. And it really... like you think, okay, somebody in this diva position, making lots of money, presumably, in charge of their game. But in not just Britney Spears' case, in some cases, people are feeling manipulated, controlled at best. Can you talk about some of the double-edged sword here?
Yeah. I mean, if you look back on the history of pop divadom, at least, you really do see a lot of stories of these seemingly indomitable women being kind of dominated and controlled by men behind the scenes, whether that's their managers or significant others, or in Britney's case, family members. You have people like Whitney Houston or Tina Turner really, really facing stories of domestic violence. You have Mariah Carey, who was basically in a conservatorship de facto of her own in the 90s. There are a lot of stories of popular women needing to really turn to the public and to their fans in order to be freed. And so Britney is maybe the most dramatic and certainly the most recent and vivid example of that. A lot of the female pop stars that came up after her specifically defined themselves in opposition or in reaction to what Britney went through and has been going through, where it's very clear now that they are the bosses of their own career, or they really make that illusion, at least, central to their performance. But Britney was not able to do that in the early 2000s, you know, as she kind of evolved from girlhood to womanhood. She started to behave like a young adult woman does, started dating, drinking, you know, living her own life, spending her own money, and doing it all in the public eye at a time when the public eye was sharper and had more scrutiny towards celebrities than it ever had, thanks to the rise of the internet. And so she was sort of like in this perfect storm moment where just by asserting her own desires, she was facing backlash and judgment from all quarters. And eventually the people who were making money from her, the people around her who could exert some control, really started to exert some more control. And she found herself in a situation where she had basically lost the rights of an adult woman and was the ward of her father for 13 years and has only recently attained freedom.
A theme that goes through your book and the different people you look for is in many ways, who controls the identity of the diva? Is it the diva, her, or in some cases himself, their manager or controlling family members, as you talked about, the fans, celebrity journalism, the internet, when that starts coming along? How much tension is there between all of those?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the diva is that, you know, she is okay living in conflict. We, as the public, maybe enjoy seeing the diva resting like in a power struggle with the people around her, with her managers and these controlling male figures, but also with the media and with her, with their fans and with public perceptions, you know, and the canny divas do seem to be able to pull the public onto their side, at least when they're at the peak of their powers. And in case after case, though, you do see these stories of downfall when the public turns and says, you know, you're demanding too much and you're not giving us enough. Your performance is starting to slip. And so we afford you these capabilities and we can take them away too.
Talking to Spencer Kornhaber about his new book. It's called On Divas, Persona, Pleasure, Power. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's talk about the gender thing. Spencer, I keep saying mostly women, mostly not, and some men. But it seems like there's something about women in positions of power. You talk about this in a little of the book that that can latch on to this diva status, the pros and the cons. Whereas a guy in this position might not be judged as negatively for the negative side of divadom. Why is that?
Right. Well, in a lot of ways, right. Like the term diva just refers to a woman acting with the same impudence that a man does, or that certain kinds of men do. That bossy, powerful men kind of take for granted their ability to ask for what they want, to set the rules of engagement, to even speak with them. When women start to do that, you know, we're not used to it. And so we judge it more harshly. And, you know, that goes really far back. But, you know, the smart divas understand this and start working this double standard into their art. You know, Beyonce has a song saying the diva is a female version of a hustler. You know, Taylor Swift has that song, The Man, which is really about, you know, if I was a man, you would all say that I'm the man. You would all like treat me like this swaggering success rather than this, you know, troublemaker.
We're talking to Spencer Kornhaber about his new book, On Divas, Persona, Pleasure, Power. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of somebody you think fits this diva category? Or do you have some ambivalent feelings about a, say, pop star in this diva zone? Join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you think about divas in this way, who is a diva? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Spencer Kornhaber from The Atlantic. We're talking about the role of the pop diva, how it's changed over the years, what it says about changes in our wider popular culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest about his work or if you have thoughts on divas or a particular pop culture big name celebrity who fits the category in your mind. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. One of the people in this diva category now is in the news, Lizzo, Spencer, and you highlight a parallel in a recent piece with a past, or I guess she's still around, a diva herself, Madonna, where they both had this persona of, you know, kind of wild. They had this inner circle of people. Things were pretty loosey-goosey sexually and things like that. both of them getting ultimately sued by dancers and others in their circles. Can you talk about what you see in those stories?
Right, right. Yeah, Lizzo's really facing some public relations and legal challenges lately because her dancers say that the environment on tour was just inappropriate. There were no boundaries. They were being kind of asked to go to strip clubs with their boss and, you know, forced into situations they didn't really want to be in. And when they spoke up, they felt intimidated. You know, it's a sort of shocking story, but it's also very familiar. If you watch Madonna's 1991 documentary, Truth or Dare, which is really a classic of the concert documentary genre, you see Madonna interacting with her dancers in ways that really kind of resemble the way that Lizzo is said to have done so. But Madonna, you know, though she had to settle with her dancers out of court, this was never really a public relations problem for her. She was in fact celebrated for being kind of like a high-handed, demanding, domineering figure. That's part of what we love about Madonna. It seems like we're moving into this era where what we want from our stars, our cultural leaders, and certainly the women in those roles is this sort of contradictory blend of being sort of like bad and a rule breaker and a troublemaker, but also being like a really nice person and a really considerate boss. You know, kind of trying to reconcile some of the conversations we've had over the past few years, like following Me Too and maybe even Meme Too, the kind of reckoning over bossy behavior and abusive power dynamics. We are now turning to divas who never had to be accountable with how they used their power before and asking them to maybe professionalize, maybe sharpen up, and maybe be a kinder, gentler kind of, you know, cultural leader. It's sort of a tough ask, but it's a little bit of a hopeful one too, I think.
Talking to Spencer Kornhaber about his new book on divas, Persona, Pleasure, Power. Let's bring on a caller. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi, thanks very much. Is there a more a historic passed back look, say like Barbara Streisand, I would say, had to be the quintessential diva of her day. Did you have some sort of historic past search,
Kevin,
for this
yeah.
diva persona?
Thanks for the call. Spencer, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can trace this archetype back for more than a century. You know, it kind of comes out of opera and the prima donna concept. And certainly Barbara absolutely fits the bill, both like with her sort of stunning, you know, vocal abilities and ability to command the stage, but also with the kind of demands she has been known for making in her personal life. You know, a lot of those demands were about how she spends her money and uses her success, you know, the opulent ways that she has wanted to like decorate her homes. A lot of things she gets called a diva for are about how she's perceived, you know, like the angle from which I believe she wants to be photographed or things like that. You know, that's called diva behavior, and you can understand it seems kind of preposterous to a normal person, but her job is to, you know, be this vaunted goddess-like figure, so she's going to want to have some control over that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Kevin. Spencer, you look at modern social media, TikTok and others, where, in theory, we all have the opportunity to become celebrities and go viral. Are you seeing at least attempts to impersonate divas as people try to go viral on TikTok and elsewhere?
Yeah, TikTok is sort of democratizing the diva, I think. I think it's very common to sort of, you know, film videos in your living room, holding a hairbrush, acting like Beyonce and doing her 8-count choreo. And some people have gone viral doing that and then become a little bit of pop sensations themselves. And so there's like a way to kind of like cheat your way into feeling like a diva. You know, we're at a time though when platforms like TikTok also make it harder to attain the kind of spectacle and vast reach and kind of production values that we took for granted with the previous generations of divas. And so I'm kind of curious to see if we'll ever have anyone reach the kind of heights of spectacle and reach that someone like Beyonce or Whitney ever did.
And Spencer, as we wrap up, you're a music writer, but is there a diva musician who you turn to for fun listening when you just need something fun to listen to, at the risk of offending the other divas, just briefly?
Well, you don't have to choose one, but if I had to, I am all in on Lady Gaga. She has been with me for a long time, and I think she's great and hilarious.
Spencer, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Spencer Kornhaber, staff writer for The Atlantic. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called On Divas, Persona, Pleasure, Power. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Republicans in the state legislature are working on a bill that would, in effect, punish college campuses accused of limiting free speech. We'll find out what's in the works and what kind of things it could change. And a lot of workplaces, especially offices, are loosening up their dress codes these days. We'll look at the new rules of what to wear at work. You can tell us what's going on in your workplace. You can get started right now. Actually, head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. That and more. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the FCC is looking to bring back net neutrality rules at the federal level for internet service providers. We'll talk to an internet law expert about what's happened since the regulations were repealed, what could change if they are reinstated. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.